Good afternoon. Welcome to the MSU Libraries Colloquia Series, sponsored by Libraries Computing and Technology. I'm Ruth Ann Jones, one of the organizers of the series. Our speaker today is Mark Hornblue, a faculty member at MSU's Department of History and the Executive Director of HNET, Humanities and Social Sciences Online, an electronic scholarly community which has its computing heart here at MSU. Dr. Hornblue is deeply involved in research projects which help educators use technology to enrich the teaching of history. In particular, he is the principal investigator for the National Science Foundation's National Digital Library Initiative grant to create a National Gallery of the Spoken Word, a digitized, globally accessible archive of significant voice recording collections, including the collection of the Vincent Voice Library here at MSU. Dr. Hornblue has his BA in History and Political Science from the University of California at Berkeley and his PhD in History from Johns Hopkins University. He'll be speaking to us today on the future of the past, history in the digital age. Please welcome Mark Hornblue.
Well, that's for me. Good afternoon. I agreed to title this talk, The Future of the Past, because in some ways it offers a nice negation to the post-structuralist assertion of the end of history. What I want to really talk about here today, however, is not limited to the history profession. I'll use examples from history, as that's the discipline I know best. But my talk is really about the impact of the digital revolution on the humanities, or on arts and letters much more broadly. Now, I must warn at the outset that historians make really bad prognosticators. And my first experience of this, my first public lecture I gave at Johns Hopkins University was November 2nd, 1980, to a crowd of 800 people. My research was in voter participation, as I confidently explained to everyone how Jimmy Carter was going to come back in the last week of the election and defeat Ronald Reagan. Historians usually don't do predicting the past, predicting the future. We talk about the past. So let me begin a little bit with an analogy to the past to set the context for what I want to talk about. I believe that we're at a moment of revolutionary change in communication technology that in many ways is comparable to Gutenberg's application of movable type. This is no small claim. I was talking to one of my colleagues this morning, and he told me that his daughter came home from middle school this week with the official list of the 100 most important people of the millennium. Of 1,000 years, and Gutenberg was on the top of the East Lansing official list of the most important people of the millennium. I want you to think for a moment about what that change meant. We take printed media for granted, but the printed media was a technological innovation. The movable type is what made printed books possible. It made our whole conception of education possible. The book is reproducible. You don't have just monks sitting in a row copying them. You could run them off on a printing press. And it's immutable. It's the same. Once you set that type, all the books that were run off from that book, all the journals, all the articles would be exactly the same. And this idea of being able to print intellectual content that would be locked in time and space and look the same is really at the heart of research and teaching as we know it. The idea that someone could research something and publish about it and write it requires that you can distribute that information. The idea that it'll be the same for all the students you distribute to is essential for teaching. The whole idea of a faculty that both advances and disseminates knowledge really depends on the technology of print. Technology, of course, has to be understood always in an economic context. And it's not only what technology permits, but what it permits affordably that's important. And there were dramatic changes in the economics of publishing in the late 19th century that made the university as we know it possible. The development of a wood pulp industry that made volume publishing affordable is really the key. Volume publishing, being able to print off hundreds, thousands of books at an affordable price, was a prerequisite for the emergence of the modern mass university and the academic profession. Universities with lectures and seminars and research all were dependent on printed material. a structure developed in Germany in the late 19th century that has really dominated American universities since then. The profession of history took this, really grew out of this development in the German university. Students went to German universities in the 1880s, studied history and seminars for the first time, came back to Johns Hopkins University and University of Chicago and Stanford University, and created for the first time history departments in the sense that doing scholarship was a profession and history was a profession. They came to understand themselves this way. And at the core of this idea was this: these people got together and they formed the American Historical Association and they published a journal. And the idea was that they would be doing research and they'd evaluate, they'd print the material and they'd evaluate each other's material. So print medium was at the core of this. And the scholarly societies in each profession, first the American Historical Association and then others formed, political science, economics, were at the key then to the way scholarship was organized. Now this, I'm one slide behind, huh? This structure was replicated throughout the world. From America, it was copied. It was brought in the early 20th century and then brought abroad in much larger sense after the Second World War, the idea of a university based upon print publication. But the key to this is always access to publication. The ability to be able to publish what you research is the essential part of the modern university. And the ability to be able to buy the books, the articles, so that is the center of teaching at a university. And one of the problems that has been in 20th century education is that this has been vastly unequal. Enormous inequalities about who has the ability to get their works published, who has the ability to buy books and buy journals so that they could teach students. The distribution of jobs and prestige and influence and the advancements of knowledge has all been based upon the print medium. Publish or perish, publish or have your ideas vanish and become ephemeral, has been at the core of the academy. And publication has meant peer-controlled print publication. Well, now, communication technologies is threatening to change all this. The whole economics of publishing has been revolutionized. Anybody who reads about publishing industry knows that it's become much more centralized into large corporations that are less willing to publish the type of things that scholars have wanted to publish in the past. Unless you're in a specific area, like I am in American history, it's very hard to publish a history book about many parts of the world today. Print publishing has become much more narrow, much more difficult, and at the same time, digital publishing, publishing online, is expanding. There's a proliferation of publishing alternatives. And this is causing a challenge, a dramatic challenge. Scholarly societies that once controlled what got published and what didn't publish now find that there are many alternatives to what they publish. Not only is the economics of publishing changing, but the medium is very different. Think for a minute about how digital information flows. It's very different than print information. First of all, it's access. There's an undeniable democratization of access. If you publish something on the web, if you publish something on the internet, anyone with access to the internet anywhere in the world can get at it. There's virtually nothing that's printed right now on the web that's sold. The only thing that is in terms of is LexisNexis and the Wall Street Journal. Even the New York Times gave up selling its content on the web. They give it away. So access and putting material on the internet means that access to it is much more dramatic than ever before. It's much speedier as well. You can find information much faster. In the history profession, most historians take 6, 10, 15 years to write a book, and then it takes 2.5 years to deal with a publisher to get that book into print, and then that book gets shipped around, and slowly people read it. That's very different than publishing something online, publishing something digitally. Also, and I want to talk a lot about this, it's no longer locked in time the way a print publication is. Digital publishing is mutable. It's changeable. Someone could forward it on and change a word, change the meaning, alter it, steal your words. The whole nature of print publication is very different when it's not between two covers, but when it's on a disk, when it's on the internet. Information is much more mutable. And this raises all sorts of questions about intellectual property and who owns ideas and who doesn't. When American academics look at these changes at the end of the 20th century, at a time, I think, when the financing of higher education is threatened, when scholarly publishing is increasingly problematic, many of us see dangers everywhere. This is an age of Jeremiah's about the death of the university, the death of higher education. Publishing, for example, I'd love to have $10 for every conference in the last 5 years on the death of the monograph, the death of the journal, what's going to happen in the future. If you look in any list of scholarly conferences, every single conference is going to have a session on what's happening with publishing. The whole nature of which scholarship had been published before is being threatened. The scholarly societies don't know how they're going to continue to publish their journals. They're losing money on them. Indeed, the scholarly societies themselves are threatened. Their role is gatekeepers of determining what gets published, what gets prestige, is eroding. And many people are, and many professors are deeply worried about this. The role of, if you think of who's been our gatekeepers to information in the 20th century, it's been scholars through scholarly societies, it's been editors who determine whether material was worth being published or not, and it's been librarians who decided what the library should buy, how it should be displayed. Well, all three of those are being threatened. The professors no longer control what's being published through the scholarly journals, and journals are being threatened. Editors find that their role is being diminished as presses are becoming more commercial, and librarians have no impact on what comes over the internet when increasing amount of material is coming in around librarians. So American academics are quite fearful of this whole sense of authority in scholarship is disappearing. There's also a great deal of fear about the future of teaching. Administrators are asking, who needs a physical classroom? Who needs professors? We could put the course online. We could sell it. We could package it. And these are raising lots of questions. But I think that all these fears are only part of the story. There's an enormous potential here as well with this new technology. And what I want to talk about today is how this new technology has the potential to change things for the better, and then maybe we'll come back and try to match these in the end with some of the fears. There are five areas that I really want to focus on here. And I want to talk about each of these for a little bit and talk about how they will change the nature of history, the nature of humanities, the nature of scholarship and teaching in the new centuries. First of all, access. Access may seem like the most simple of these features, but in fact, it may be the most important. The ability to get at intellectual content. To get at intellectual content in an affordable way. Think of what is now available online. Major public institutions like the Library of Congress, the British Museum, the National Archives, as well as private collections and private individuals are digitizing their intellectual material. Material that you used to have to pay a plane ticket to go to Washington, pay a hotel bill to stay in Washington, get out of the Library of Congress in a laborious manner, you can now find online. You can find this material for research, and you can find this material for teaching. And you can find this material from anywhere in any corner of the world. I just got back from Africa just last week and visiting some African universities. I was visited the major research library in Dakar, Senegal, and Dakar was the capital of West Africa. And it is no exaggeration to say that the major research library in Dakar fits in this room. And if you were a student or you were a faculty member in Dakar, and if that's what you're limited to, that is enormously limiting on your involvement in the international intellectual community. And the difference between having access to an internet where you can now have material that comes from Library of Congress, comes from the National Archives, comes from the South African National Archives, and ultimately will come from their repositories as well, is enormously different. This allows material for teaching. For example, if you think about teaching multiculturalism, if you're in a small college in Montana, and what resources that college had before, and now the ability to go to the National Archives site and see and take a lesson plan and take resources on the history of the integration of baseball and Jackie Robinson and deliver that in that community. This is dramatically different. And material for research. Probably the area that this has made the most progress is actually in classical studies. There's a project that's been going on for more than a decade now called Perseus that has digitalized virtually every piece of primary material we know about the classical world. Images, artifacts, text, and it has made all this material available to anybody who teaches classics anywhere in the world. That's an enormous difference than what existed before. On our trip to South Africa, we met with the South African National Archives and talked about ways to make the reports of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission available online freely anywhere in the world. Think about the difference of what it'll mean for people writing history so that everyone would have access to that material. The alternative would be that they will be deposited in a university called Fort Hare, which is in the middle of nowhere, literally. It's the place where Tolkien wrote Lord of the Rings. It's in a homeland institution in South Africa where it's very difficult to stay there. The conditions are very difficult. The history that will be written to have access to those materials is very different. So access alone, I think, dramatically will change how we see the world. But it's not just access to printed material. We also need to think about the types of material. The computer revolution, digitalization, also provides access to multimedia material, to sound and images, so we can see pictures of our past, so that we can hear voices of the past. I'm working on a different project with a political scientist at Northwestern. It's part of this Voice Library project, and he digitizes oral arguments to the Supreme Court. And he has a great example he shows. He gives the example of the Roe v. Wade case, and he plays the oral argument. And very early on in the case, the lawyer for the government that's arguing against abortion rights tells what is, you know, a very unpleasant sexist joke. And he clearly expects that the good old boys on the Supreme Court are going to laugh with him. And after he tells this joke, there's just utter silence in the room. And then he goes back to speak again, and you realize he knows he's already lost, that the whole case is over, that he's coming at it from a completely different perspective. If you read the transcript, you'd never find this out. You wouldn't know how they react to the argument that he makes. Listening to that oral argument is a completely different experience than just reading the transcript. Listening, when I play for my students John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, they can get the sense of why this was inspiring to a generation. If you read John F. Kennedy's inaugural address, you just have a sense, boy, this guy used a lot of hyperbole. It's not the same thing. So there's a depth and richness that comes with sound and images. And this is true both for the researcher who's writing the history. If you write the history of abortion rights, listening to this case is essential. It's very different than just reading it. And it's also true for teaching. Third, I would like to suggest also that the digital revolution is bringing, by cutting the cost of publication, it allows us to publish in ways that we as scholars would want to, that we and teachers want our students to be able to read. It sort of breaks the tyranny of the marketplace. For example, professors always want footnotes. We always want to tell you everything, why we said this, where our sources are, and the like. And every book publisher in the world doesn't want to let us use footnotes. They say nobody will read the footnotes, it costs too much to publish it. Well, it doesn't cost anything extra to put footnotes online, to put them on, if you publish online, or if you put them on in addition to a book. Same thing for data sets. If you do analysis of numbers and you do write an economic history of how the economy has declined, no, it's been very difficult in the past to replicate that analysis. Now the scholar can put their data set up and let other people test it. So the ability, the change in sort of the cost of publication, the democratization of publication that comes with the digital revolution, really will change the way we do scholarship and the way we teach. Fourth, I think that it also allows us to publish in a very different way. A book goes from one page to the next to the next. The essence of publishing in a book is linear publishing. The essence of the World Wide Web is linking, is hypertext, that you don't have to publish in a linear way. Publishing online opens up opportunities for scholars who see history as more open-ended. It opens up ways to give multiple viewpoints without privileging one, without making one come first, without having one follow another. There's a great example of this. A couple years ago, the Smithsonian tried to do an exhibit on the bombing in Hiroshima, and they commissioned scholars to work out the exhibit, and the exhibit was designed to tell different parts of the story of Hiroshima. But when it came time to put it together, no matter how they put it together, people were offended because one part of the story was being privileged and not the other, that they were trivializing part of the experience by not doing the other. In the end, the Smithsonian threw up its hands altogether and refused to deal with the exhibit. Well, an exhibit like that designed online can tell the story of the families who lived in Hiroshima, the story of the airmen who had to deliver that bomb, the story of the political decision of whether to drop it or not, without making them have to physically juxtapose. That offers new opportunities. It offers challenges. It offers problems as well, and we'll talk about those in a minute. And finally, the digital revolution also opens up a possibility for communication, for two-way collaboration, for interactivity. Every single study that's been done about new technology shows that what people like the most, down from my 10-year-old daughter up to senior professors who use email, what people like most about the revolution in communication technology is interactivity, is communicating, is two-way communicating. Students, the ability to interact with each other, to interact with the professor about the content is what's most exciting about using this technology in the classroom. For scholars, the ability to interact with other scholars is what's particularly exciting. On one of our HNET lists, the one on Africa, got on a discussion a few years ago about the economic development of Africa from 800 to 1600. Very esoteric topic where none of the people who study that area teach at any university with anybody else interested in that area. That's the way universities work. Their colleagues are people interested in this were all elsewhere in the world. But by discussing this online through a discussion group, they were able to connect up with other experts, with people in different fields, in economics, in history, in environmental studies, and have a discussion about a topic that would have taken decades to emerge through print media that over a period of months emerged rich directions in each of their research. So that this interactivity that's at the core of the digital revolution is also one of the main appeals. In the end, I think that we will... Am I supposed to change slides? I think so. In the end, I think we will judge the impact of the digital revolution by whether it changes the way we see the world or not, whether it really opens up new insights, whether bits and bytes, digitizing things, breaking information down on the computer and distributing it around the world, opens up a new way of viewing the world, the same way that understanding that major intellectual revolutions in the past have opened up new paradigms to understand the world. I think that each of the things that I've talked about so far will enable us to see the world for differently. Think about access for a minute, access to new primary materials. the materials, the story of the South African struggle against apartheid are going to be buried in this University of Fort Hare. The numbers of scholars who will go see him there in the next 20 years, you can probably count on two hands. That means that the story of the South African struggle will be told without any of those documents unless they're digitized and put online. They'll be told from the records that are kept at the South African National Archives, which are much more accessible, that were made by the white police officers and made by the white politicians. Opening up access to diverse materials allow people to see history differently. One of the best examples that we have in American history is that one of the fathers of colonial American history was a scholar by the name of Perry Miller at Harvard. And he wrote definitive studies on how American culture and American love of freedom grew out of a particular type of New England religious environment. And when he published his books, he deposited all his notes and all his records at Harvard Library. And for decades, nobody looked at his records. And then later, scholars went back and looked and realized that, in fact, he had only looked at a very narrow section of the relevant sources, and that by expanding the sources beyond what Miller had looked at, scholars have come up with very different interpretations of colonial American history. Well, the same thing, I think, is fundamentally true about the digital revolution, that by expanding access, we will open new ways to see things. And it's also important to think about who has the access. Who can see the resources of our past? It won't just be the scholar at Harvard who could win the fellowship, who could spend 6 months in the British Museum. There's something fundamentally democratizing about expanding the access by lowering the cost. Secondly, think about multimedia. I would argue that by listening to voices, seeing images, we'll have new insights into material. I already gave that example of the Supreme Court. Another is there's a project at University of Virginia that looks at how Mark Twain was marketed. There's been a long argument in American studies about racial attitudes in Twain's literature for a long time. And this argument had always been based on the text and looking at the text. Well, now this project at University of Virginia has digitized all the marketing material about Mark Twain's works and has shows, and you can see how the material was marketed very differently in England than it was marketed in the United States, and how the American marketing played upon American racial fears in a way that the British didn't. And it opens up, it's an interjection into this argument. It's added evidence to go along with the textual analysis. Third, if you think about rapid publication, I think here too we allow the ability for new insights. Scholars talking to each other, talking across disciplines. Part of what the digital future involves is not just putting material online, but it's developing new tools to find connections, to build intellectual connections, so that we can look across different disciplines and engage in different conversations than we had in the past. Electronic indexing and searching allows faculty members to get out of their own departments. If you're here on MSU's campus, ask sometime faculty members how many times they talk to people outside their own department and outside their own discipline. The sort of the physical walls of the buildings on college campuses are replicated intellectually, and that really changes and has changed, and there's studies that show it changed when we move to bits and bytes in the digital revolution. It's much easier to cross those boundaries, and there are lots of research being done to develop tools to encourage that. The same thing is true for international collaboration. It used to cost a fortune to be able to work with somebody internationally. You had months to send letters back and forth, saving to be able to spend a month together every couple of years. And now scholars are able to write back and forth by email many times a day, or to chat online freely with people internationally. And the perspectives that are opened up by this international communication is enormous. And finally, probably most importantly, is this question of hypertext. Is the idea of writing intellectual material, developing intellectual material that is not linear, that challenges us to think and publish in different ways? What does it mean to weave multiple narratives, to look at the evidence from multiple points of views? This is the most challenging change that the technology brings. If you think about again, let's go back in history. Think about the shift before this, the shift from rock to paper. Right? This was what really, if preservationists really lose when we move from rock to paper. When people used to write on rock, it lasted a really long time, but you couldn't write anything very long on rocks unless you had lots of slaves building walls for you to do this. You know, a few Egyptian monarchs could, but for the most part, when you wrote on rock, chiseled it on rock, you could write very short text. Well, the shift from rock to paper allowed for the development of text to get much longer, much more complicated. Well, the shift from paper for the computer means that we no longer have to go from page to page. We now can go in multiple directions at the same time. The essence of the digital world is that it's not linear. This is what's exciting. This is also what's challenging, what's threatening, what's problematic. The danger here is that it can become a cacophony, that the scholar doesn't choose what's most important, that doesn't tell you the story, that you lose what scholarship has been about, and many people are afraid of this. The danger is also, how do we translate our evaluation methods to cyberspace, where we evaluated material based on through scholarly societies, through peer review and the like? How do we change that to the digital world? How do we evaluate hypertext writing? This challenges our imagination. It challenges our sense of what history can be. To finish, let me go back to history for one second. At the middle of the 20th century, intellectuals in this country, and indeed throughout Europe, were terribly fearful that technological change would allow political powers to rewrite history. George Orwell's nightmare, to be blunt, dominated the intellectual thinking of mid-20th century world. The idea of 1984, the idea that a political power could rewrite history, rewrite the world, write people out of it, change it. This whole sense of totalitarianism is one of the most dominant intellectual constructs in the way the 20th century academy developed, the way history was written. People agreed with this, disagreed with this, played off against it. But this vision, this nightmare, was really at a core of a lot of how we understood the 20th century. Well, George Orwell's now been proven wrong. We know, in fact, that the technology does not have centralizing powers the way he feared it did. In fact, it has quite the opposite. It has an inherently decentralizing power in terms of controlling intellectual content. The worldwide revolutions of 1989 showed this. No matter how much governments tried to control the flow of information, new technology went around them. The Tiananmen Square uprising was based on fax machines. The Eastern European uprising used the internet, used fax machines, used new modes of communication. Totalitarianism was unable to control this. And I think there's no reason to ever expect that to be reversed. The essence of the World Wide Web, which didn't even exist in 1989, is decentralizing publishing, decentralizing the ability to give out information. But if Orwell was wrong, I think we have another maybe nightmare or Jeremiad or thing to fear for the coming, at the end of the century. That's the idea of basically the trivialization of information. Information as entertainment. Orwell's nightmare isn't what's making the world. Bill Gates' dream is what's making the world, or Bill Gates and Michael Eisner together, where information is entertainment and everything is for sale in little pieces, where everything is equal. And one of the challenges, perhaps I think the most profound challenge facing scholars, facing teachers, is to figure out how to deal with this, how to control this new technology, how to take the best advantage of this new technology without everything being trivialized. The future of history, of liberal arts scholarship, of teaching is not clear. What is it to publish in them? Non-linear fashion, does that mean everything is relative, that there's no authority, that there's no truth? That's, how are we going to tell narratives in a non-linear fashion? How are we going to decide what is legitimate scholarship and what isn't? How are we going to weight what we're going to teach future generations? All of that is open questions at this moment. And I believe that there's really a crying need then for us, for intellectuals, for faculty, to students, to engage in this issue, to recognize the impact of this new technology and the economics of this new technology, and then to strive to bring it under control. That this technology is permissive. It opens lots of opportunities, but then it creates a real challenge for us to figure out how to move into the next century. Thank you. Questions? David? It does.
So, I mean, this is, you know, if Brave New World is talking about the switch is one in which you have all these marvelous possibilities of connectivity. What about permanence?
Yes, I think that's a real important question. We could turn it. I'll answer the web question second, but first, think about the permanence of books. Anybody who, regardless of the computer revolution, anyone who's been trying to assign books to their students in the last 15 years has discovered that every book that was in print last year is no longer in print. And the access to books and the permanence of books is a real problem. Who has access to it? If you have Doe Library at Berkeley or Harvard Library, you can get a lot, or the Library of Congress, there are three copies in one in each of those places that you can find. But much of the world has no access to a lot of that print material. So that what's being offered here is more widespread access, is continued ongoing access, whereas the economics of print has really made that quite difficult in terms of books. I think in terms of the way the web exists today, this is certainly a real challenge, the ephemeral nature of things. And what's needed is to translate the type of standards, right? When, as a history profession, we said that this work of scholarship is done when it's codified into a book, right? And that book then was put between the whole pages and it was made permanent. Well, somehow we need to develop the type of standards and best practices that's done electronically, and then that material is saved and preserved in a certain way as well. It seems to me that yes, the ephemeral nature presents a real challenge, but on the other hand, what we have today is not only ephemeral, but scarce, terribly scarce.
Yeah.
I think we want the teacher and the scholar and the mediator to use that word. I don't know whether that necessarily requires a linear narrative, but I do agree with you very much on the need for scholarship, which you wouldn't call the mediator, for somebody. I mean, what a scholar is somebody who says what's important here and what does this mean, is somebody who comments on this, that the essence of what we do as historians or as literature professors or the like is really in that role of mediation, is in that role of analysis and talking about. So I think that's right, and that's certainly one of the problems. And a lot of the people in dealing with the new technology, I think, forget this. One of the major problems we face in universities as university administrators are enamored with this idea, oh, it'll be a lot that people misinterpret it, that they think you can just put the archives up and not have intellectuals, to put it cruelly. But on the other hand, I think that it's, having those archives available is an enormous opportunity for the intellectuals and for the public then who can have access to the mediation as well as the intellectual material. Well, I think, if we talk about, let me talk about it in the world of teaching. I mean, I think there's one of sort of a crude slogan that goes around now that we should move from the sage on the stage to the guide on the side. That teachers used to be, give wisdom out, and now you're just supposed to guide the students. Well, I don't really think that that's sufficient. I think that teachers really do offer mediation. They do offer that there is a role for engaged teaching with the material, and not just to expose people to the cacophony of voices of history, for example. In terms of the this comment up there in part is meant in the world of the university. I mean, I think that, what we do as faculty members and as teachers needs to be at the core of how universities deal with this new technology. And too often the decisions are being made about this new technology based on economics, based upon what's as sexy, and without pedagogical or scholarly concerns at the core. And because especially humanists feel that this technology is distant and hard to understand, we surrender control to just to administer. Comments, question? I think, in fact, we've done a pretty good job so far, and partially it's because of the sort of institutions of public information that have been real active in this. I mean, the Library of Congress and the National Archives have digitized this enormous amount of material, and the National Archives has put up really exciting lesson plans and educational material, and they've sort of set a standard here, and they've set a challenge. Nobody can sell stuff they're giving away. And in some sense, it's almost been a race against time. And universities like MSU and University of Virginia and others are playing a role in this, that by translating intellectual content to the web free as part of our land-grant mission, as part of the mission of the Library of Congress and National Archives, and showing that this doesn't happen without the role of the mediation and the teacher, and designing it in a way that has intellectual content and isn't just a cacophony of voices, we are in fact shaping the way intellectual content will be delivered online. So I think that part of the way this is being done is by acting and by institutions that have really moved forward and taken chances and done that in some sense. Yes? Okay, well, thank you very much.